So as I said, in the 27th chapter, we are told that after spending several years, Felix, then Festus, and Agrippa being imprisoned there in Caesarea Maritime, that finally the determination was made that the appeal to Caesar would be accepted, and it was determined, as stated in verse 1 of the text, that they would sail to Italy. Now, I do want to remind you very quickly of what we discussed in our last weeks of study, as we talked about the defense that the Apostle Paul gave of himself, declaring his innocence and declaring God's word before Festus, the governor or prelate of Judea. So he's a Roman, he's a Gentile. And then King Agrippa and his wife Bernice, who he asked for advice. There are a couple of responses that we talked about last week. First of all, Festus, in his flattering response to Paul, he said, "Paul, much learning has made you mad or caused you to be beside yourself." So he thought Paul was a bit crazy for these things that he was emphasizing and living his entire life, being willing to suffer even to the point of death for this man Jesus and what all that Paul was claiming. King Agrippa had a very different response. He was moved by Paul's appeal. We talked about this a little bit, whether or not it was legitimate what King Agrippa said when he said, "You almost persuade me to be a Christian." No evidence that he was finally persuaded, but it seems like that Paul's words did have an effect upon Agrippa, because he had that knowledge of the law and of the Jewish religion and such. And he recognized that their Messiah was coming, and he's almost convinced that Jesus indeed was resurrected from the dead, and that the Christian faith is the faith that was alluded to in the Old Testament. But we do not see that he ever did respond to his statement in this particular text. So possibly, probably not. Probably not, or else I think it probably would have been noted at some point in time in the remainder of the New Testament writings. But both Paul and Festus, Agrippa and Festus agreed that Paul had done nothing that was worthy of death. Agrippa going so far as to say possibly he might have been let go if it were not for the fact that he appealed to Caesar. So they had to send him to Caesar by Roman law, and of course by God's decree, because God had already determined that Paul would go to Rome and testify of him there. But they understood that what the Jews had concocted with regard to their accusations against Paul were not legitimate. And it is interesting, because you see, not only in the trip that Paul takes to Rome and in the shipwreck, but also, as we'll see in Acts chapter 28 and in Philippians and other places, Paul was treated with a great deal of respect. I think that the behavior of Felix and Festus and Agrippa and perhaps the centurion, there was at least a sufficient sophistication to know that what the Jews were saying is not so. Now, he's now out of Jewish control, and we can do with it what we want, and it really wasn't something that was worthy of mistreating him like you would another prisoner. And so it seems like on this particular journey that Paul was treated differently. And indeed, it seems like during the time that he spent, his first time in Roman imprisonment, as he was under house arrest and was allowed to receive individuals daily, that he was respected and that he was treated differently than other prisoners would have been treated. So I think that's an interesting point to be made. What the palace guard came to understand, as Philippians 1 tells us, is that his bonds were in Christ. The reason why he was serving his imprisonment was not because he had done anything wrong, but simply because he was preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. So let's begin by noting this shipwreck and the journey itself. And there are a few things that we want to note about it. You may add some things to mine. This will be pretty much a straightforward historical account with some of the references to God's providence and such contained. And we may get through it fairly quickly. I don't know. We may not be able to see all of it, but regardless, there's not a lot of doctrine here. So if you want to read it on your own time, if we don't get through it all, I think you'll have an understanding of it. We're told in verses 1 through 8 of the text that when it was decided we should sail to Italy, They delivered Paul and some other prisoners to one named Julius. So Julius is a centurion of the Augustan regiment, and he's the one in charge on the ship. The ship was of Adramyttium, and it was put to sea, meaning to sail along the coast of Asia. You recognize they didn't just take across straight across the sea. Sailing was very different then than what it is now. So he mentioned some of these places that they went. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, was with us, and they went to Sidon. And Julius treated Paul kindly and gave him liberty to go with his friends and receive care. Seems like he understood that Paul wasn't about to leave. Paul wasn't going to run away. Paul wasn't going to try to escape. There was no indication of that, as was seen. And he had been there for some period of time in Caesarea. So very possibly Julius had an understanding of what kind of prisoner Paul was. And so these liberties were granted. When we had put to sea from there, we sailed under the shelter of Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. Now here we're getting into the concept of the possibility of a shipwreck. We had sailed over the sea, which is off Cilicia. Pamphylia came to Myra, a city of Cilicia. And the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy and put us on board there. So now they're going to Italy. And they sailed slowly many days, arrived with difficulty off Cnidus. And the wind was not permitting us to proceed. So we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmon, and passed with difficulty, coming to a place called Fair Havens near the city of Lycia. So you can see that the first part of that journey was a very, very difficult journey. And that's a significant point to be made, and we'll make it in just a few moments' time. Again, I'm going through this, and I sometimes answer the questions beforehand, but would anyone have anything they would like to add on why the centurion would treat Paul as kindly? And I also note this, and I misspelled does there, so I understand that. How does this compare with the desire of the soldiers in verses 42 through 43? If you'll just jump ahead, this is after the ship, or during the shipwreck, they were afraid that the prisoners would escape. We are told the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim away. But the centurion, this is Julius, he wanted to save Paul, so he kept them from the purpose. So you have the soldiers' attitude toward the prisoners in general. You have Lysias' attitude toward Paul. So compare and contrast those as to what the reasons might be and what the actual attitudes were. Anything you want to share? Yes, Rachel.
Well, like Jeremy said, Julius probably already knew about his innocence and his character. Festus may have told him about that already. And we've also seen in chapter 24... soldiers, towards the end of the chapter, are selfish, and they're just worried about themselves, because that's a steep price to pay, which I think is death if you let a prisoner escape.
Sure.
That's what they're worried about in their own mind.
Yeah, good. And there's something here maybe that we can see, too, between the difference between the leader of the men and the men themselves as far as the soldiers. Either maybe with intellect, there may have been a reason why Julius rose as high as he did as a centurion. I think that primarily it was that selfish thing, but also the soldiers would not necessarily make the differentiation that Julius was making. And prisoners are not good people, typically. Prisoners are dangerous and evil. So they didn't care about the prisoners. They just wanted to protect themselves. So there was that selfishness. Yes, Justin.
There's also the fact that he was a Roman, and the centurion would be the one that would be held responsible if the Roman died in his keep.
Okay, so with regard to that, there could be a distinction made with regard to the prisoners that were being sent to Rome, that some of them were citizens and some were not?
Yeah, the likelihood that they were all citizens is very, very low.
Yeah, there was, 370, or is it 274? How much? Gone? You had your name. Is it three or two? Two. 270 something different individuals that did not die as a result of this. We'll get to that in just a few moments, where it was possible that many would die, but God protected them for Paul's sake. So it's a good point to be made with regard to those things. The second section is in verses 9 through 12 of the text. It's a bit shorter reading, that Paul warned the centurion. So again, Paul was well treated, but Paul was still a prisoner. You know, kindness or well treatment, I think it became very much respect. But Paul was a prisoner. He wasn't a sailor, was he? And so we are told in verse 9, which much time had been spent, and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, that Paul advised them, saying, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives. What we're about to do, if we do it, is very, very dangerous." But the centurion was more persuaded. More persuaded. So the centurion was the one in control. But he was more persuaded by the sailors with regard to sailing. That makes sense, doesn't it? So that may be an indication that yet there wasn't that full understanding of what Paul was saying here and what Paul understood. But he was persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship and by the things spoken by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable, Fair Havens wasn't a good place to winter. So they sail from there, the majority advising, so that if by any means they could reach Phoenix, which was a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there. And so this is what they were hoping was going to be able to happen. This was the dangerous thing. Obviously, it was something that was dangerous because they'd had so much difficulty beforehand. So the question that I have in this, when Paul said this, "Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only the cargo and ship, but also our lives," was that warning of a shipwreck a prophecy from God? And if so, how do you know that? What's the indication of it, if it is, or is it not? You're right. That's an interesting point to be made, isn't it? Because Paul indicated that he was predicting death for a lot of individuals. Now, I've put right here is the danger was something probably pretty obvious. And so others felt the best course was to sail, but Paul perceived. That may have been just simply common sense. He was a smart man, and it was dangerous. It may have been just caution. If there is any indication, it's the "I perceive." Later on, it was stated to be a full-blown prophecy, but the prophecy, the angel of the Lord standing before him said something far different, that no one would die. And in Paul's initial statement, he was afraid, so God had not yet at least revealed to him that there would be no loss of life. So if that were the case at that point in time, Paul may have made some inferences. If it is God that said there's going to be a shipwreck as a result of this. But I'm with Dennis. I don't think that this was a prophecy at all. I think this was common sense from a man that the centurion may just rejected it because, you know, let's stay out away from Rome for another winter before we have to go to it. Just a prisoner just saying, let's bide our time. Let's not be in a hurry right here. I don't want to be in a hurry to go to my execution type of a thing. But regardless, they would have stayed there. They would have made provision. They would have tried if it had not been that the sailors convinced the centurion, the majority saying, no, we can make it. And I remember I think the show was The Perfect Storm, maybe. I forget what it was, but there was a statement. I read an article about it, but the idea that here a storm is coming, but the fishermen, they think they can make it. And I've seen a scene from that movie where they're going straight up a wall of water trying to get up to the other side to save themselves, and they didn't make it. So just because you're a sailor, it means you're bold. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're very smart, but we're told that here the counsel was given to them rather than to the Apostle Paul on this occasion. All right? Now, here we get into some interesting things in verses 13 through 26. So, the south wind blew softly. They thought they had obtained what they wanted. They set out to sail close by Crete, but it's too late. Not long after, there was a tempestuous headwind that arose called Euroclydon. And when the ship was caught and could not head into the wind, we let her drive. And running under the shelter of an island called Clauda, we secured the skiff with difficulty. So now they're having to ride out a storm. They had taken it on board. They used cables to undergird the ship, fearing lest they should run aground on the Syrtis sands. They struck sail and were driven by the wind. Because we're exceedingly tempest-tossed, the next day they lightened the ship. So this is how bad it is getting. They got caught. They tried to anchor. The anchoring's not working. They're afraid that they're going to be driven, so let's let it go. But they don't know where they're going now, do they? Because it's a sailing ship. And it's a heavy wind. And so they're not able to control themselves anymore. So what do? Okay, we're going to sink unless we make the ship lighter. You've heard of this. You've seen movies. You've seen shows. You've read articles. All these kinds of things. How do you save yourself in these difficult conditions? So they should have listened to Paul, shouldn't they? But they did not. So, the third day, he said, we threw the ship's tackle overboard with our own hands. And then neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small tempest beat on us, and all hope that we would be saved was finally given up. This is how bad it was. It was just how terrible. You remember on the Sea of Galilee in that fishing boat, Jesus was there asleep in the stern, and the disciples were afraid they were going to perish until Jesus said, peace be still. But their fear was the same. They thought they were going to die because of the storm, this power. I'll give you just a different example. When I was a number of years ago, when Jeremiah was probably 6 years old at the time, so it's been a while now, 25 years, we went floating on the river down by New Braunfels. And that's something everybody does. And because he was so young, they said we could lash our floaty things. They're called tubes. I forget what their names are. So we could lash them together. Well, I was so smart as an individual, I thought, well, he's young, but he's not that young. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to tie them together, and I'm going to just leave a little bit of space so he can he won't be lashed to dad all the time. He'll have a little bit of space. Well, we got down to some rapids, a little bit of rapids, and he went on one side of a tree, and I went on the other side of the tree. And we both went over. So here my son, he had a life jacket on. I didn't. I come up in about chest-deep water that's flowing hard. And my son is nowhere. And I don't know where he is. Now when we hit, I was pretty heavy at the time. And so we hit, and the tubes went like this. And then we flipped. He got caught under the water at the tree. And I couldn't see him. I knew where he was, though. I knew he was at that tree, and I had to get to him, and I was about 10 foot beyond it against the... I've never been stronger, but I still didn't get there before he popped up. I mean, there was no way that I could fight against that. That's just current. That's just a little bit of current in a lazy river that I couldn't go strongly enough to protect my own child. And fortunately, he was able to scramble up the trunk of the tree and get his head above water until I got to him, and that was the last time I'd ever tubed, and never will. Too, because of that particular thing. So I thought I'd lost my son for just a short real period of time as a result of that, because of the power that nature supplies. And it was nothing in comparison to this. So they had lost their even ability to think that they were going to live. And so they had given up. But after a long abstinence from food, Paul stood in the midst of them. And this is when he said, men, you should have listened to me and not have sailed from Crete and incurred this disaster and loss, but I urge you to take heart, for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. The ship's going to crash. We're going to lose it, but we're not going to lose any life. There stood by me this night an angel to God, to whom I belong and whom I serve. So now Paul's saying, in effect, not with hubris, not in any overt way, but people got this. Hey, God's on my side, and he promised me that you're going to be okay. So now everybody's listening to Paul. Before, not everybody listened. They treated him okay, but not everybody listened to Paul. Now, it doesn't indicate that the soldiers were listening, but the commander was, the prisoners were, maybe the soldiers were as well, but even though he said there would be no loss of life, soldiers had determined to kill the prisoners, so we'll get to that in just a moment. But we are told he said this, and he said, don't be afraid. Paul, you must be brought before Caesar, and indeed God has granted you that all those who sail with you, has granted you all those. So in effect, he said, this is a provision that God is giving to Paul, that the people you're sailing with, I'm going to let them be saved as well. I'm granting that to you. It was a favor that God granted to the Apostle Paul. Therefore, take heart, men. For I believe God that it will be just as it was told me. However, we must run aground on a certain island. And isn't that exactly what happened? And so, again, went through that so we don't really have to answer it. But verse 3, there stood by me this night an angel from God to whom I belong and serve, indicates indeed that it was a prediction from God. I'm sorry I did this late last night, and Juan read as warned. I had to fix that as well. So there were some typos here that I didn't fix. But that's the answer to that question. Anybody have anything they want to supply about verses 13 through 26 that pretty much make up the most important aspect, or a big important aspect of our narrative, indicating God's providential care upon Paul and all who were on board during this shipwreck? Any thoughts?
Well, verse 24 has been brought out before because the Lord himself told him he would have to appear before Peter. And here he's telling everyone on board that the angel told him, you must be brought before Caesar. So he knew he wasn't going to die.
Yeah, he knew.
He despite what he said earlier. Plus, we go back to Acts 9, and the Lord told Ananias he will stand before kings. How many kings have he stood before?
Get that one.
Yeah. He's got another king to stand before.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, I wonder about this, because we are told, as a result of what he said, that we are told that they took heart because they listened to what Paul had to say, and they ate and took heart, and they were comforted with regard to it. So here is this man who is very explicit with regard to what he says. First of all, he said, now maybe they didn't make a distinction between his first statement and his second statement. Except for the fact that God has granted that you all are going to live too. You're not going to be any loss of life. And so maybe they thought the first prediction was valid. I don't know. Perhaps they were touched by Paul's demeanor, because he definitely was not afraid, was he? Because he understood God's providence and the fact that God had promised him he would get to Rome. And so he wasn't afraid. Here, everybody's getting up for loss. We're going to die. We're going to perish. Can you imagine the cacophony on board with regard to all of these hundreds of people that are nearing death, and Paul's just as calm as he can be? Now, he may have been troubled until such time as the angel told him no one's going to die, but he knew he wasn't going to die. And so this statement was just an interesting statement, again, indicating God's providence and what we said in our first lesson today, that if God wants it, God gets it, doesn't he? That nature itself is a tool of God. That God can determine will take a life. God can determine will not take a life. And what God wants, God gets. And God says, none of you are going to die. Now, when I look at the actual events which took place, there wasn't a miraculous sealing of the storm. They did lose the ship. These things did happen. There was just the saving of these individuals. There may have been a lot of waterlogged prisoners and sailors that got up on the Isle of Malta. It may have been a very disturbing and dangerous time for them, a scary time for them. They perceive it to be dangerous. But the fact is, the sea didn't take any of them. We need to understand that God, as the curator of all things, as the one who created and who has control over the winds and the waves, the sea, that God is the one who determines what nature will take and who nature will spare. And if he determines that they would be spared, there's nothing that the sea could say, oh no, we're going to take this one. You see that, don't you, in mythologies and all, where the gods trying to protect, or superheroes trying to protect, but then something unforeseen or untoward happens, and not able to save that one. Save most of them, but not able to save that one. And you see that in Greek mythology, you see that in Marvel superheroes, those kinds of things. But not with God. That's not the case with God. And so let's keep that in mind, that this indeed was something that God said would happen. So now we get to verses 27 through verse 38 of the text. And so now we find that Paul's being listened to, and people are going to do what Paul said. So we are told, when the 14th night had come, they were driven up and down in the Adriatic Sea. About midnight, the sailors sensed that they were drawing near to the land. So, okay, there's a sense. They're sailors. They know what they're doing. So they start taking fathoms, 20 fathoms. When they got a little farther, 15 fathoms. And they were afraid again. Okay, so they already had to loose the chains that girded them early on so that they would not break the ship. But they're afraid, now we're going to run aground. We don't want to do that either. And so as a result of that, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for day to come. So just hold us out until then. Maybe we'll be all right. But we're told as the sailors were seeking to escape from the ship, when they had let down the skiff into the sea under pretense of putting out anchors from the prow, that Paul said to the centurion and soldiers, unless these men stay in the ship, you cannot be saved. Saying something again about sailors, right? They're getting the skiff. They want to go to the land. They think they can get there. The big ship can't get there. The big ship may run aground. We may lose lives, but maybe we can get there in the skiff. Let's tell them we're putting out these anchors and let's get out of here. Leave them to themselves. Again, that's part of characteristic of mankind. It's an unfortunate thing. It's a temptation that besets us from time to time as well, doesn't it? Is that save yourself, forget everyone else, we always give such a great credence to, for example, our first responders, and rightly so. You have selfless men and women that when danger presents itself, rather than running away from the danger, they run toward it. Now, if it were my own family, children could take care of themselves, but my own grandchildren that were in danger, I would run to the danger because it's my grandchildren. If none of my family is involved, let's say that there's a shooting or something and I can get out the back door, am I going to save and run toward the shooter? I don't know. I don't think I will. I think I want to take care of my own family. I want to be a grandfather and a father to them, and I'm right by the back door. I'm going to get out of here. You know, maybe that's happening. And in fact, it's interesting when you get in concealed carry class, that's exactly what the concealed carry instructors tell you to do. Don't be a hero. This is to protect you and your family. And if you're in those kinds of situations, you don't need to put yourself in danger. If you can get out of it, you get out of it. Okay. But these first responders, people they don't even know. Okay? And any hero, we say that, people, they don't even know. Maybe I would have that heroic bent in me. I don't know. It won't happen unless that circumstance arises, and I pray it never does. But first responders, they made a determination with their life long ago in their profession. They're going to run to the danger. And we always hold them in high esteem, that willingness to go. But you have people like this, the sailors, and again, we're talking about the soldiers. The centurion, he said, the soldiers cut away the ropes of the skiff. You can't get away, all right, and let it fall off. And so now they're all stuck on the ship. As the day was about to dawn, Paul implored them to take food, saying, today is the 14th day that you've waited and continued without food and eaten nothing. I urge you to take nourishment, for this is for your survival. Not a hair will fall from the head of any of you. Maybe their despair was in part because they were hungry, because they were fasting, because of their danger and their fear. But we are told that when he said these things, he took bread, gave thanks to God in the presence of them all, and when he had broken it, he began to eat, and they were all encouraged, and also took food to themselves. Now this is where I made reference to earlier and couldn't remember the number. 276 persons were on the ship. When they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship. They threw out the wheat into the sea. Okay? Paul, this man, we're placing our trust in Paul. An angel came to him. He has everything under control, doesn't he? Okay? He said, eat, let's eat. And then let's throw everything else out, because this is going to be our last meal until we get on the island. And so they made it as safe as they possibly could, and they lightened the ship, threw out the wheat into the sea. And so, again, I'm answering the questions kind of as we go along today, but with regard to that indication that Paul's influence increased during the voyage, why do you think that that is the case? The prophecy, one. What else? His demeanor? Does anybody have anything else in regard to those indications? It's an interesting thing. Not everyone fully trusted him. Sailors, I'm going to get away. And then the soldiers later on tried to kill the prisoners. They wanted to take life, so they weren't helping God, were they? But all of them here, everyone we note, they trusted in Paul. Maybe it was just because they were in such despair that they thought, well, it's all over anyway, 2 weeks, we're in the midst of this great storm, we're going to die anyway, and so we might as well eat, have this last meal. But we said they're comforted. So that's an indication, again, that Paul, he had an influence upon them. Yes, Chris.
I just think it's amazing. You got these 270-odd people on board, and you've got soldiers, you've got sailors, you've got prisoners, everybody has their own agenda and goal and fears and all that. And it was just, it was chaos. And if not for Paul and this relationship he formed with Julius, Paul didn't have the authority. He needed Julius to be the authority to help here. Now, if it hadn't been for Paul and Julius, this would have just been a disaster. And I think one of the things, you know, I see through here is when we keep seeing the people taking selfish actions against soldiers here just a little bit, but they're stopped from doing that. But again, it's both Paul and Julius are acting not as, you know, they recognize the situation they're in. We're no longer sailors and soldiers and prisoners. We are now like people trying to survive.
Yeah.
And so it was like, you did this, don't do that. I'm not going to beat you up for doing that. I need your help.
Ah, gotcha.
And they unified the people together.
That's
to that goal.
Good point. Good point. Certainly. Anybody else? That gets us now to then the final section of the study, which would be verses 39 through the end of the chapter. It said, when it was day, they didn't recognize the land. They observed a bay with a beach. So they didn't know where they were, but there was a bay with a beach, and they wanted to run the ship into it if possible. So they let go the anchors, left them in the sea, loosing the rudder ropes, and they hoisted the mainsail to the wind and made for shore. But striking a place where two seas met, they ran the ship aground. So they didn't make it to the beach, did they? They ran the ship aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable, but the stern was being broken up by the violence of the waves. So again, we talk about the power of nature. So they're stuck, and the waves are hitting. One is still, but the other one is loose, and so it's just being torn apart. The ship's being torn up. It was indeed a shipwreck. The ship was indeed lost, as God had prophesied would happen, or that the angel had told Paul would happen. And so the soldiers, now this is where we get that point, the soldiers had planned to kill the prisoners. And let's just harken back to what Rachel said earlier, the selfishness of the soldiers and this idea of self-preservation, because indeed, maybe there would be some lenience on the part of the Roman officials. The soldiers would not be held accountable because, after all, there's nothing they can do with regard to nature. But it may have been that one leader would say, hey, when you saw that the ship was going to be destroyed, you should have killed them all. We're not going to let them get loose. But we're told that on that occasion, the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, but the centurion, wanting to save Paul, kept them from their purpose, commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land, and the rest, some on boards and some on parts of the ship. And so it was, all 276 escaped safely to land. So this was not far offshore, but so it was close enough to swim to shore, but it was a raging sea, and it was dangerous. And surely, in that situation or scenario, if God's providence was not at hand, some would have been lost as a result of this. Some of them could not even swim. So the ones who could swim, swam. Those who could not, we are told, got on boards and parts of the ship, and they all escaped safely to the island. Now, we'll spend some time in chapter 28 talking about the island and the time that Paul spent there in Rome. I do want to emphasize again the question the soldiers planned. Why did they plan? Well, maybe they didn't believe Paul fully. Or maybe Paul's prophecy, maybe they had an inkling or an idea, or possibly maybe their faith wasn't strong enough. But basically, they didn't want to get into trouble by losing prisoners. It was typically, again, an egregious offense that would lead to a loss of life. But this indicates the character of these soldiers, that these individuals were worthy of death. Some of them may not have been. Some of them may have been executed later on. I don't know. It's up to the prison system and Caesar himself with regard to those who were citizens. But the fact is, the soldiers didn't care. And their selfishness and self-interest led them to concoct this plan. Yes?
I just wanted to say something about this chapter as we're coming to a close or a lesson? I have the time to do something. This chapter is very important in establishing the authenticity of this book. Because the details are just incredible. Someone who wrote this 100, 200 years later could not have come up with what happened.
Uh-huh.
Luke was on board the ship.
He saw it.
He was an eyewitness of everything that happened.
Yeah.
And we know Luke was a physician. He was not a sailor.
Right.
But it made a big impression on him. He wrote it all down. I think for that express purpose. Now, what did we learn from 1 Corinthians 11? This was not Paul's only shipwreck.
No, he's in the deep many times.
He had been shipwrecked 3 times. Yeah. No doubt, some of those, if not the other two, was before this. No mention was made of those, except in the letter of Paul. But we don't know of any other shipwreck that Luke was involved in.
Maybe we can end in that. Just recognize, because we see it. The book of Acts ends basically our discourse on the life of Paul with regard to the details of his ministry, other than what is supplied from time to time in the letters that he wrote. For example, we talked about his second imprisonment that is seen in the pastoral epistles in Titus and Timothy, 2 Timothy. We don't know a lot, and there are not a lot of details supplied other than this, but we do know, as he indicated in his text to Corinthians in the 11th chapter and in some of those other things, that Paul was a very, very brave individual. Brave in the sense that no matter what happened to him, he was willing to go through it. He was very, very dedicated and diligent. He also was very trusting, because he trusted that what God said would occur. And those are good lessons for each and all of us to learn as well. So while these are not doctrinal, they're basically, it's a narrative of a shipwreck. There is a lot of things that we can learn from it, and I think it was a good study for us to have here in chapter 27. So that gets us to Malta and gets us to the beach that they were on and how the natives treated them, and then his journey to Rome itself and what happened when he got to Rome. So we'll talk about that next week. And then we're finished with this, and we'll get into a new book following that. I appreciate very much everyone's kind attention today. We got just a minute or two. Does anyone have anything that they want to add to what we've discussed, either here or at any time in our study, because we do have just a moment before the bell rings. About 1 minute. Anything at all? Okay, we'll stop just a little bit quickly then, and appreciate very much your kind attention today, and we'll pick up there in Acts 28 next time.